This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Greetings and welcome to Animal Instinct here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Celia Kutcher, and I'm also known as the Food Healer. And today we have a really intense interview here. I'm really excited about this. I've got James J. Brousseau, who's the author of Dignity, Pleasures, Vulgarity, Philosophy, and Animal Rights. So we're going to be talking philosophy. So bear with me, guys. It's been a long time since I've had this topic, but I'm going to try to like make you guys proud of me. So James, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
I'm happy to be here. We'll do the best we can. With the
well, you're
Greeks
fine.
And such.
Yes. You're good. I'm the one that's going to be like, babe. But your book is fascinating. I read it over the weekend. It was really, really, I'm amazed by it, actually. And I think the timing of it is really great because animal rights right now is a really, really hot topic and people are starting to really understand what that means. And I think that your book really brought in a lot of points regarding what that means, what the definition of animal rights is. And so I loved it. So thank you for sharing it with me, for starters. Let's start with what led you to write this book.
Right. I was writing a chapter on animal rights for a textbook I was writing. And one thing that writing a textbook forces you to do is really get back to the basics. Mm. You start to see things from the ground up, and you try to imagine as you're writing, okay, now I'm writing not for other professionals or others mm-hmm. who have been severely severely disciplined in these things. But no, people are coming into it fresh
yeah.
and are asking new and fresh questions. And so it changes your mindset. And so as I was going through this textbook work, which was kind of heavy and burdensome and it was toil, right? I began to think that one thing that we rarely do in philosophy is we rarely explain in human terms the foundation or the sensations and the way we can live mm-hmm. the ethical foundations
yeah.
or we can experience the ethical theories in our bodies. We don't explain how we feel and live ethics. Instead, at least philosophers, we tend to just throw words around, theoretical words like mm-hmm. dignity, utilitarianism, Kant, that kind of thing,
right.
Names, concepts, and so on. And we just assume that everybody knows. But what I began to think about as I was writing about animals as well, okay, what can it mean for an animal to experience dignity? And what can it mean for an animal to experience pleasure and pain? Mm-hmm. And of course, we can't know those things directly.
Yeah.
But that's what led me to begin to think, well, I haven't really even explained, and most people haven't explained, well, what is the human experience of dignity? What is the human experience of pleasure and pain? And
that's
what are the different
point.
Ways of thinking about it? And so what this book is about, and kind of spun out of the textbook, is it's an attempt to think in very human terms about the theories that drive animal rights. And there are two basic theories. One is about dignity, and that traces back to the philosopher Kant. The other is pleasure and pain, and that traces back to a school called utilitarianism. Mm-hmm. So that's the first two parts of the title. But what's going on there is I'm trying to swim through both human experiences and the philosophical theory as it's applied to animals to try to get a sense of what the ethics is about underneath the animal rights movement. So that's a long answer, right?
No, it's a great answer.
To what got me going, but that was sort of the process I followed. And then I'd just like to come back just very quickly
to one
other thought. You made the very good point that this is a good moment for animal rights. I think it's also a critical moment for the following reason. The work of the work of activism has more or less been done. I don't mean the activism in the street, but I mean the theoretical work of activism.
Okay.
That is that the hardcore theory has been laid out by people like Peter Singer and Tom Regan.
Mm-hmm.
And then the holes, the gaps that they left in their theories, those have been filled in by other experts and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sort of now in a, just entering now, I believe, as my sense is, a kind of second stage in the talk about animal rights. And this is the point where we don't talk so much about animals as objects or things and kind of slap a theory onto them.
Yeah.
Instead, what we're trying to do is think, okay, well, animals are part of our experience. And in thinking about them, how can we think about ourselves and vice versa? So I think that there's a moment in animal rights that's happening right now, which is very interesting. And I say it's kind of a second stage or a movement past this first hardcore theoretical assault upon the idea that animals do not have any ethical existence.
Right.
And that assault, I think, has been successful on the theoretical level.
Mm-hmm.
The case has been made that people agree or disagree.
Yeah.
But the case has been made the way we're going to be able to make it.
Yeah,
And so that's why we can begin now, I think, to move on and think in more human terms about the way we live together with animals.
Well, one thing that it makes me think of is, God, I don't know the year on this. I really should. But I think it was up. It wasn't until like the 70s or the late 60s where scientists realized that fish actually had a nervous system.
Well, I think to a certain point that they weren't even looking.
That's a good point.
It wasn't until sort of on the philosophical side. It was 1975, I believe. Don't quote me. was Peter Singer's Animal Liberation. Then 1983 was Tom Regan's
case framework. God, that's so recent.
And before then, there was almost nothing.
Wow.
The way we thought about animals institutionally, philosophically, et cetera, before then was not in ethical terms for themselves, but to the degree that we would try not to mistreat animals.
Yeah.
The reasoning was, I will not mistreat my dog because, and only because, that might lead me to mistreat other human beings.
Oh, wow.
Right? It wasn't, there's this idea of mediated ethics, right? We didn't avoid cruelty because we wanted to avoid cruelty to the animal.
Right.
But just because we didn't want to insert into ourselves this idea we can be cruel.
Okay.
And that comes from Aquinas in the Catholic tradition going back to the,
you know,
the
time of Christ,
400 AD and so on, right? And so that notion has dominated animal rights until really very recently. The entire, at least academically, the entire school of thought has developed very rapidly in the last just decades. So things change. Philosophy is usually not like that. In philosophy, usually it's eons for the smallest change, but in this case, it's been a pretty quick development.
That's really cool, and that's really nice to hear. And it's, you know, I feel like until recently, animals were just kind of like here for us, basically. You know, it's like a form of entertainment or a form of food, or, you know, just kind of like their purpose on this planet was to serve man. And unfortunately, that's changing a little bit, and I think people are starting to understand that in many cases, it's the opposite of that, you know.
Right. For those of us who have dogs, it does feel that
totally.
Way sometimes.
I got two cats. I'm like, you know, the slave in my house with these two cats.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about that just before we started, actually, a little bit.
Yeah.
About this, we were just mentioning your show with the Spaniard and the hunting dogs. And I was commenting that my wife, who's Spanish, grew up in a hotel in Spain. And Spain has also modernized very rapidly.
Yeah.
When she was growing up, her dad would take the dogs out hunting for days at a time and come back with racks of rabbits and so on, which was the food for the hotel. Imagine growing up like that. Your dad literally goes out with a shotgun and the dogs out into the woods and comes back right at some point in the near future, hopefully, right? And then that's the food that you cook for the next week or so in the hotel. She was born in a place that didn't even have electricity.
Mm-hmm.
Spain was really a very kind of backward place for a long time because of this devastation of the Civil War and then the dictatorship of Franco. The country kind of got stuck.
Yeah.
So in any case, that's kind of going to our cultural history. But her relationship with dogs was, as you're saying, just purely useful. Now, the dogs were well treated, but they were hunting dogs. Yeah. They were working dogs.
Yeah.
And she says that their names, just so that her dad could rally them, their names were all monosyllables. Do, re, mi. So he'd go get something. He'd check out, well, there's do, there's re, where's me? And he'd scream for me, and then me would come in the forest, that kind of thing. So that's just a really different relationship with dogs and animals generally that I think that, for instance, my children have, who grew up with the dog and have an emotional, their first connection is an emotional connection.
Absolutely.
As opposed to a utilitarian connection.
Totally.
And so that's a whole different kind of way of relating, I think, to animals.
And it's funny, I mean, when you sent me this book and I saw that it was in Spain, in Pamplona, like where it's based, I was like, oh my God, because I lived near there. I never made it to Pamplona because I used to get terribly car sick. So like anywhere out of Elizondo was just not happening. But I was there for San Fermin, and, you know, the book discusses bullfighting. And so I never made it to a bullfight. And honestly, I was so sensitive that thank God I didn't, because I probably would still be traumatized to this day. Yep, I'm not that person, you know. But yeah, when I was in Spain, I mean, we're talking, Franco was still around. It was towards the end of his thing. I don't want to admit how old I am, so I'm going to kind of stretch this, you know. But it was a very, very different place. And the way that I spent a lot of time on a farm, because I was there to learn Spanish, and I was very shy. And so I spent all this time on the farm because you don't have to talk to animals in Spanish. So it's like my solution to this. And, you know, it was a cattle farm, and so they were producing milk, and, you know, the babies were sold off for veal, and there were a couple pigs and a donkey and some other stuff. But these were all like servants, basically, you know, and like some of the cows had names because I named them, and the farmer felt really guilty, so he kept the names. But it really was a different, it really was almost like master slave.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where there was no equality, and there was a barn cat, but she wasn't a pet. She was there to get rid of the mice. Like they all had certain duties and certain purposes and jobs. And the whole bullfighting aspect was so interesting to me on so many different levels. That's why I love why it's in this book, because of tradition. Same as the hunting dogs. It's the same thing. It's that deep, deep, deep rooted tradition and what is right, you know, quote unquote, and what isn't right and what's ethical and what's not ethical. And I would love to talk about the bulls a little bit because I didn't know anything about them. So if you could share what you know about them, that'd be great.
Right. The running of the bulls and then the bull fight. Well, this is, I use this as a backdrop because it captures, it seems to me, fairly well a human aspect of the two fundamental ways that we talk about animal rights. One is this idea of pleasure and pain. And the ethics here is traces back, as I mentioned earlier, to this idea of utilitarianism. And the idea is quite simple. It's that the ethically right action is just the one that maximizes pleasure and minimizes pain.
For
that person, but then as a generalized theory, you would say, well, then we're going to do what's best for everybody, right?
Okay.
So that's, curiously, you've put your finger right on one of the problems with the theory, right? One of the, well, what some people think is a problem, because let's imagine, for example, that, this is just purely theoretical, but let's imagine that you're very wealthy, and me and my philosophy friends are not at all wealthy. Under this theory, if we have the opportunity, it would make sense for us to steal a good portion of your money.
Totally.
Why is it? Because you would be sad that you lost some of your money, but that sadness would be more than compensated by the happiness we poverty-stricken philosophers would feel as we charge off to get our beers and that kind of thing, right? So there are problems with the theory, but there are ways to manage it and so on. In any case, one way of thinking about ethics for humans is this idea that we should just always do what maximizes pleasure, minimizes pain. And then the move that that Peter Singer made is he said, well, okay, I'll buy this idea that we should maximize pleasure, minimize pain, but shouldn't that go not just for humans, but for anything and everything that feels pleasure and pain? And so then that's the move that he made into animal rights. And then from there, then the discussion comes, well, do animals suffer pain, or do they have pleasures? And there are a lot of interesting questions that you can ask about the running of the bulls and the bull fight. What's pretty clear are two things about the bulls and the bull fight. First, as you know, of course, these bulls are reared on terrific, wonderful estates. These are the pride of the Spanish farmers, these bulls that will be used in the bullfight.
See,
royal treatment. There are few animals anywhere that receive the kind of treatment that Spanish fighting bulls receive on the way to their experience in Pamplona
they're beautiful.
They're gorgeous, perfectly muscled
totally. And they're shiny and like
their health is impeccable, etc. So their lives are enviable by any measure.
Until
that one very bad experience when they go to Pamplona, and the way it works is they're trucked in. On the morning of the bullfight, they run through the streets. Mm-hmm. I suspect that most of your listeners know kind of what the bulls are. You know, kind of seen little images, things like that. So they have a bad morning, just chaos, fear, disorientation, everything that's bad, followed by a worse afternoon.
And
one of the things about the bullfight is, as I sort of pointed out in the book, bulls are, even though they're can be violent and aggressive creatures, they're not naturally that way. And so they do need to be sparked into their aggressiveness. And there's a very elaborate ritual that's used in the bullfight of inflicting pain through swords and spears.
Pinchy things.
Right, stage by stage to rile them up. That's the way it works. Right. And then finally, of course, death comes, and the death is painful.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are thinking about ethics in terms of pleasure and pain for the bulls, something really interesting comes up about for these bulls. If you have just a case of animal cruelty in terms of pleasure and pain, you say that's ethically reproachable. That's it.
Right.
But the bulls, it's interesting because they have this terrific life.
Totally.
For so many, it's a number of years. I believe they fight at three. So let's say it's 3 years of wonderful life.
Yeah.
And then one very, very bad day.
Yeah.
Right? And so then you ask yourself, well, in terms of pleasure and pain, what is the balance there?
Yeah.
And it's especially forceful for the bulls for this reason, because if we don't have the bullfight, if we say we're going to ban the bullfight and not have it, then those bulls will simply not be reared. Right, those farms will turn their fields to other purposes, and the Spanish fighting bulls will disappear largely.
And is this like a certain breed that they use that would wind up being extinct?
I'm not sure if the breed would be extinct, but there are three or four kind of breeds they use. And then it's also just worth noting quickly that the Spanish bullfight happens in Spain, but also in Mexico, and Peru, Argentina, and through South America. And there are little differences in each place, so it's hard to speak about the bullfight
because
they're different.
That's fair enough.
But coming back to the main point, so we have this question, which is kind of an interesting question, at least for a philosopher it is.
Yeah.
So if you as a person, this is the kind of thing I like to use the book to bring out. If you as a person had the following choice, you could not exist at all, or you could have a great life for like 3 years and then, or 30 years or whatever, and then have a horrifying the worst. Thrown into some street, things will hammering at you, swords everywhere. Right? Would you go for that or not?
That's a really good question.
I have to say, instinctively, I was very surprised because I would go for it without thinking twice.
Really?
I'm going to be great for 3 years or what have you,
exactly.
And then, well, I'll deal with this bad moment. But some people react very negatively to that. And I think it has to do maybe to some extent with whether you privilege pleasure or pain, right? I mean, some people say, look, I want pleasure, and if I have to deal with some pain, then I'll take it.
Yeah.
Or is it, I just want to avoid pain, and it's not worth the pain even if I get some pleasure on the side.
So, or you get the fatalist that's like, life sucks, it's all pain, and then we die, and then we go to heaven, and everything's good, you know?
Well, the good thing, the utilitarianism is perfect for these people because, by definition, it leads to a bad ending for them. They should bring that ending upon themselves.
That's wild.
That's a dark turn. Anyway, let's go back.
Yeah, but you know, it's what it is, sadly. We actually need to take a break, which I don't want to do, but I have to, because if not, my sponsors will kill me. We will be back in a minute and a half to discuss more with James Rousseau about his book, Dignity, Pleasures, Vulgarity, Philosophy and Animal Rights.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledged the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
We are back. I am talking to author and philosopher James J. Brousseau all about his book, Dignity, Pleasures, Vulgarity, Philosophy and Animal Rights. So, you wrote about the premise that all dignified animals have ethical rights, but what makes some animals dignified and others not?
Well, that's an excellent question.
I'm really sorry. It's a deep one.
This is interestingly one of the reasons I wrote the book to begin with, because that's the kind of question we should also ask about human beings too.
Right.
Historically, the idea of dignity, just to go back to the start, just for a moment, there are two fundamental ways that we think that creatures deserve ethical rights. One is in terms of pleasure and pain. So if a creature feels pleasure or suffers pain, then it's part of the ethical world and it's part of the discussion. The other way is this dignity front. And we say that any creature that has dignity intrinsically merits ethical protection.
Mm.
So then the question is, okay, what is this dignity?
Yeah.
Thing, right? I mean, where does this come from? What does it feel like, et cetera? The fundamental answer historically has had something to do with rationality.
Okay.
That the ability to think about your experience, to plan for the future, to comprehend your past, to understand time as an arrow, as purposeful, and to make something of it, to make plans for the future. Anything that can do that is dignified.
Okay.
Now, so that works. That's terrific for human beings, but there are some problems there.
Yeah.
What about a baby? Is a baby dignified?
Mm.
It sounds like under this definition, and we're live in Roberta's here, just for Rich. I'm looking at some babies out in front of us watching us. Well, I'm looking at a baby right now. Does this baby have dignity? Does this baby think coherently about his future and past? I don't think so.
Yeah.
So there are these difficulties within the definition of dignity is rationality. So the other way that we've thought about dignity traditionally is we've said there's something about being human that means or that demands that we should be treated only or at least whenever possible as ends and not means. What does that mean? That signifies that human beings should not be used as things that are replaceable. So, for example, for example, if I'm holding my phone right now, if my phone were to break, I would just get a new phone, and I wouldn't feel like anything was lost as long as it's the same model and make and so on, right? So phones are replaceable, but there's something about being human that makes us not replaceable.
Yeah.
And that quality is dignity itself. Now, now then there's a next question. Well, where does this quality come from? I mean, why is it that we have human beings have this quality of being irreplaceable?
Mm-hmm.
Or why is it stated slightly differently? If you made a perfect clone of me and charged a new brain with all my memories, why is it that that thing would not be me and not be worth as much as I am? And the reason some people will say, well, is because there's something in the law of nature that makes human beings singular and we can't be replicated. Others would say that there's something genetic.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's either nature or it's something in my humanity. Someone takes a religious approach. They might say that it's a soul or something like that. So there are all kinds of explanations. But no matter which explanation you choose, where you're headed is toward the idea that there's something unique in a specific living human being, in you and I, that makes us valuable in ourselves, in and of ourselves, irreplaceable. Mm-hmm. It can't be replicated. And that's the reason why we deserve protection. That's the reason why someone out there should not just come in and steal my money and so on, because I'm singular. I have value in myself. What Tom Regan said in his book is, he said, well, let's define dignity in the following way.
Mm-hmm.
Dignity is the ability not so much to think about your experience and be rational, but let's say that dignity is instead just the ability to understand your experience in time, to understand the past, present, and the future. And as soon as he says that, then that opens the way for some animals to have ethical rights.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems like, at least many higher mammals, mm-hmm. it seems quite clear that they can understand, let's say that a mammal that's trapped in a zoo, it seems quite clear that this mammal goes to sleep at night
mm-hmm.
Knowing that he or she has been in the zoo and expecting that he or she will be in this cage again tomorrow.
Totally.
And so what he and those who work along his side say is that there's not just biology, but also biography. And any creature that has biography, that understands itself as moving in time, that creature has dignity. So there are these two different ways of thinking about it. The traditional human way has been biography plus rationality.
Mm-hmm.
What the animal rights proponents want to say is, you know what, rationality is not so important.
Mm.
It's more the sense that you're moving in time. And if you have that, then you are intrinsically valuable and deserve ethical protection.
Okay.
That is, you should be allowed to autonomy, live freely, and so on. So that's a long answer, but that's sort of how we define what dignity is.
Yeah.
And how we've moved those who are proponents of this theory, how they've moved from the idea that dignity is human-centered to perhaps centered upon all those animals that have a sense of themselves in time,
mm-hmm.
or what's technically called the subject of a life.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, cool. And so then that kind of leaks into speciesism, or speciesism?
Speciesism.
Speciesism, yes,
right.
Okay.
Right, because the idea is, I mean, if we buy that idea,
mm-hmm.
that anything that understands any living creature that understands a past, present, and future has dignity, then there's no reason to exclude a dolphin or a higher mammal or so on just because they happen to be non-human.
Yeah.
Right? If all that matters is that you have a sense of yourself in time, then there's no reason to say four arms or two legs or what have you.
Right.
Difference. And then where this intersects with animal rights is kind of interesting because, or at least it seems so to me, because the height of rational dignity mm-hmm. for human beings is frequently associated with our cultural traditions, which is exactly the bullfight. Right?
Yeah,
the bullfight is a triumph of human reason,
yep.
and also it's a harvesting and a packaging of human passions, mm-hmm. right? It depicts the human experience. The bullfight depicts the human experiences that as the matador salutes his favorite in the stands, and faces death and survives it, and so on. So it's a highly rational, passionate, very human experience,
mm-hmm.
and so there's something in the bullfight which is pure dignity.
Mm.
And so if you look at that, you can see it two ways, and this is what makes the bullfight very interesting.
Yeah.
People who are in favor of the bullfight say, look, that no animal could create this kind of majesty of this kind of majesty of almost kind of rational creation of the passions, and therefore animals don't deserve rights.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas by contrast, others look at that same bullfight and they see a bull who does understand itself, or if not a bull, maybe there'd be a debate about that, but some higher animals that understand themselves right, as in this experience.
Yeah.
And they say, well, the same bullfight you're using to justify the idea that we don't have animal rights proves the opposite, that we do, animals should have rights.
Totally.
And so one thing about being kind of a philosopher and approaching these issues is, I think anyone who does philosophy, is that we like moments like that,
mm-hmm.
Which capture simultaneously both sides of a debate
and kind of
let people think it through for themselves and come to the conclusion. Instead of trying to push people toward a conclusion, let people think it through and come to their own way of thinking about things.
It's a really tough call, because it's like with the bullfights, I mean, like I said, I never spent any time around them. I was like, not happening. But like to find out that these bulls are treated like royalty, before their life and aren't just like, you know, some like random bull. Like that already really changed my mind on it because it was like, oh my God, they're being respected and really treated. But the fact, you know, if they're like when they're in the bullfight, I've seen them run through the streets because they used to do that in my town with calves and scare the crap out of all the kids, which was super fun. They didn't like that at all. But it was like you could see the fear in the animal. You know what I mean? And you could see like cases where they would either cower out of sheer fear or they would just react and fight back. So like they were, you know, in my book anyway, out of the mind of a 10-year-old, I believe that they were experiencing pleasure and pain by their reactions. Mm. You know, so like I think that if there's some like lower species, like let's go for like a jellyfish, okay, we're going hardcore here. I want an extreme. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, you can poke it and things like this and like you'll probably get stung, but it's not going to attack you, for example.
Well, the pain will be yours. But
exactly.
Not it.
It's your own damn fault. You know, but then you're looking at an animal that's this massive, massive beast that is realizing that something is going on and, oh my God, I need to defend myself. Mm. You know, so that kind of puts a human, you know, human angle on it because I don't have a better word for it.
Right.
But to also show that, you know, it's not just some massive sack of cells that's letting you do whatever you want to it kind of thing.
Right.
You know, like it will respond.
Right. And then so and there again is curious because you can say, look, in that moment, you see both sides of the debate because you see that the human dignity, which is the creation of this theater, but also you see the dignity that perhaps exists in the animal, like in the fact that it responds, and the fact that the animal takes, in a certain sense, takes responsibility for his or her condition. And then going back to the question of ethics, one thing that we like to think of in terms of ethical rights, you know, the idea that you deserve some protections from things, is we like to think that that also implies some sense of responsibility. That you defend yourself.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it doesn't have to be responsibility in the sense that you know, we don't expect a bull to help an old grandmother across the street, right? But there is a sense that, as you put it exactly, that you see it in the eyes.
Yeah,
they defend
do.
Themselves. They take responsibility. This is the situation in which I find myself thrown, and this is the situation in which I will respond to. And perhaps that, too, is enough to say that there's dignity there. So all of these things, all of these questions are sort of open and curious, and they're going forward, as I say, from this kind of second stage of animal rights, the one that after we've made the arguments in favor of animal rights, where we can begin to step back and reflect, well, how do these rights exist in terms of human experience, and how can we see them from both sides, and how can we discuss them in ways that are fruitful and interesting?
So as a philosopher, when you were doing research on this book, was it difficult to keep like it not to be non-judgmental and just kind of look at the evidence that you had in front of you, or were you taking sides?
I suppose there are people are different this way. We hear a lot about in the universities today about professors in one school or another taking such. But my experience is it's not that way. That most academics, and I like to count myself amongst this, when I teach a philosopher like Plato or Kant or something, I try to almost be like an actor and throw myself into it as forcefully as I can and say, I fully believe in this theory.
Yeah.
And like you, I don't want to give away my age, but I've been doing this for a good number of years now, right? And so it's become very natural for me when I see an argument to throw myself in it and just adopt it fully with my with my core. And then, of course, I step back later on and I say, well, this is what I think personally.
Yeah.
But what this book is about is not that, because as I say, I think that stage, we've already got that.
Yeah.
And if you're looking for a philosopher who will give you the firepower to protect animals, you should go for Peter Singer and Tom Regan. Mm-hmm. They've got great books or books about them.
Cool.
And they will give you what you need
to
debate in favor of animal rights. Whereas by contrast, if you want to think a little more deeply about the issue in general and think about ourselves in relationship with humans, that's kind of what I'm about.
And I love that because, you know, obviously I've got a show about animals. It's about animal education, animal welfare. At the end of the day, I would like animals to have rights and, you know, not get wiped out and become extinct and screw up our planet because of it.
Right.
But I wouldn't be able to do what you do because I would be like, no, it's, yeah. you know, it's Mickey Mouse and he's got a family and, you know, it would, I just wouldn't be able to take that scientific view of it. And I really, really appreciate this book and I appreciate you coming in and talking to me. I hate the fact that our time has flown by in 5 seconds. I feel like you just sat down.
We haven't talked about vulgarity yet.
I we'll know. Have to, we'll I'm like really bummed out. We're going to have to do another episode on you, which I would love to do actually to continue this conversation if you had any interest at all. But for where can people find this book?
Oh, it's out on, it's out. Just as a quick note, this is a cup of coffee book. This barely deserves the title of a book.
It's give me a break, man. Long... It took me a long time to read it. It's a good book. It might be small, but it's mighty, my friend. My God.
But this is I think we envisioned it as a Kindle mainly, but of course it's paperback available and there's an Audible version. I think it's out. If it's not out yet, it will be out soon.
Cool.
You know, it's out in all the various forms and all the...
Cool. And if anyone has any questions, would you be willing to let them reach you? If you're not, it's cool.
absolutely. Anyone can reach me very easily. My webpage is jamesbrusseau.net, all together. So jamesbrusseau.net.
Perfect.
There's a contact. I'm happy to get emails and so on.
Perfect. Sure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate this interview because it was really nice to have this conversation. And like I said, I mean, the book's not long, but wow, it's dense. And it really opened up my eyes and really made me think about all these different aspects, which is something I don't normally do. So I want to say thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you. I'm glad.
It was great. Happy to be here. It was really great. And if anybody, you know, seriously, like this is a book that really is, it'll really make you think. So if you want to like get your brain rolling a little bit, pick this thing up because it was fascinating. And like we've said, it's not a 1,000-page book, so you can get through it pretty good. Thank you guys for listening. Unfortunately, we're out of time, which is a bummer, but I will be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, I hope you have a great week. Stay dry if you're in this snowstorm path. Just be careful. Don't do anything stupid. Don't go out. And I will talk to you next week. Take care.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.